Welcome to Houston Sports Talk with your host, Robert Land.
Thanks for checking into the best Houston sports podcast, the Astros. Man, they're taking water faster than the Titanic right now. And to help me break it all down, all the way from London is without question the biggest Astro fan in the UK, George Martin. Great to have you on the show, George.
Hi, Robert. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me on.
I know you've been asked this question probably a million times, but you're no relation to the Beatles genius producer George Martin or the Game of Thrones George R.R. Martin, right?
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth. I always follow up with a Game of Thrones reference, but no, I'm no relation to either. If I could have even a 100,000th of the talent which either one have had in their respective fields, then I'd be doing pretty well.
Yeah, I'm specifically a big fan of the Beatles guy and a big fan of the Beatles going way back. So that's... It's a nice name anyway to be stuck with that name in England, I'm sure. And for those who don't know your story, how and when did you become an Astros fan?
Right, yeah, it dates back to 1999 when I was 14 years old. I played a lot of cricket here in the UK. I had no knowledge of baseball whatsoever. Happened to be up late one night. The TV was on and it was the ESPN Sunday night and Wednesday night baseball broadcast, which I kind of just stumbled across. Thought this looks interesting. Want to get involved a bit more. Had no connection to America at the time whatsoever. So my thought process was, if I want to get into the sport properly, I'm going to need to decide to pick a team to support. So I had to kind of work out who was going to be the one which would be the best fit for me. I didn't want to go the glory hunting route. So the Yankees were immediately off the table because it was right in the middle of their that dynasty with which they had. So this was in 99. First sight of the Astros would have been probably around August time for me. It was actually Mike Hampton who first attracted me to the Astros, because we're not quite talking about Shohei Ohtani levels of being a two-way player. He could hit well for a pitcher, and that kind of translates to cricket, where you have what's called an all-rounder, someone who can bat and can bowl equally well. And that was the first thing, the first hook which brought me towards the Astros. The other thing was that they were an exciting team that hadn't ever won a championship, so I thought this was a good story to get behind. So I made the decision before the 2000 season, I'm going to be an Astros fan. But then, lo and behold, Mike Hampton gets traded to the New York Mets. So I had a dilemma. Do I stick with the Astros, or do I follow Mike Hampton and become a Mets fan? I thought, no, I can't. You know, I'm not going to follow a player around because I'm going to end up changing the team that I support every season or two. So I'd said no, made my decision. I'm an Astros fan, and 24 years later, here I am.
And as a Brit, you probably appreciated a little bit Jose Lima, like to drink, like to party a little bit.
just a great character. I mean, rest in peace. He's sorely missed to this day. And that's the great thing about the Astros. I mean, I'm sure other teams' fans will say the same about their guys, but you look across the history of the Astros, we have had so many great characters across all these different eras to this day. It's a wonderful thing. We've been very, very blessed with the players that we can count amongst our number.
Yeah, not just that, but great people with the Astros. The best players were also great people, you know, start with Nolan and Bagwell and Biggio and all that. And we're doing this Tuesday afternoon, and just another terrible Josh Hader performance on Monday. The strength of the Astros pitching staff, George, was supposed to be that back half of the bullpen, but Hader, Abreu, and Presley, just a disaster. 9 ERA between the three of those guys. And what part of this, though, is Jim Crane or Dana Brown or Joe Espada's fault? They can't do anything about it. These guys were supposed to be great.
Yeah, on paper, it looked like it was the perfect storm of this kind of three-headed monster at the end of the back end of the bullpen. I still think, you know, it's still early days in the season. I still think that it will come good. I think it's unsettled Ryan Presley a bit because he was so settled in that closer role that the fact that he's now had to kind of get used to being a setup guy again, you know, definitely a sea change for him. I feel like he'll be all right. He kind of lives on the edge anyway with the way people get on base, and he's always pitching in stressful situations. So I'm not too worried about Ryan Presley. Brian Abreu is an interesting one because I wasn't expecting him to struggle at the start of the season, and he's had at least a couple of performances which are definitely below the levels which we've come to expect of him over the last 2 years. But of course, as you said, Josh Hader is the real $1 million question, or should I say $95 million question, which we can't afford him to not live up to the billing that he's been given. And in terms of, I mean, again, it's early, so I don't want to attribute fault at this stage, but would it have been a better idea to replace these middle relievers that we lost in the shape of Ryan Stanek, Hector Neris, and Phil Maton, rather than going for a closer, which we already had an elite closer? Was it something that we even needed? I think we all celebrated the arrival of Josh Hader, and again, nothing against the guy. I've seen him before elsewhere, and I know that he's an extremely high quality closer, but hasn't displayed that for us yet. I don't know whether it's a case of our bats aren't giving him enough chances to come in a safe situation. I think he's only had two and he's blown one. So hopefully it's a case of once he gets two or three successful saves under his belt as an Astro that he kind of settles into that. I'm sure it's a bit of a upheaval and disruption for him on a personal level, just trying to get used to new surroundings, even though he was here, 2015 when he first got traded by the organization. But yeah, it's a difficult question. I don't know what the immediate solution is. We need to not panic. That's the main thing. We need to have faith in these guys because we know that they're all talented. There's no one there who, you know, no one's stealing a living. Everyone in there is there on merit. They're there because they have the talent to deliver. It's up to Joe Espada to find the solution. It's a difficult one for him because he keeps bringing in Hayter in non-save situations. I wasn't so keen on bringing him in yesterday. I thought that going with Presley would have been a better option. But, you know, Presley had that bad outing last week against them. I can't remember who it was against. That game where he gave up four runs of his own.
The thing that bothers me, though, George, is I hear some fans saying, well, you can't pitch Hayter until it's a save situation. If that's the case, he can't pitch because the Astros aren't getting save situations.
Yeah.
And number two, I hear, well, Ryan Presley, he doesn't know how to pitch as not a closer. Most of his career, he wasn't a closer. No. He was an all-star for the Astros 5 years ago as a setup guy. He just became the closer like 3 years ago, you know, when the Osuna thing didn't work out.
Mm. No, it's true. I remember I had concerns about whether Presley could become a closer. So, you know, that's not very long ago. So I think there's definitely an adjustment period for switching between the roles. But, you know, he's a seasoned professional and there's nothing there which he can't do in that respect. But, yeah, in terms of the usage of Hayter, when you bring him in, yeah, you can't only use him in safe situations because, like I said, he'd only pitch in two games. So it's a difficult one. And I do sympathize with Joe Espada on that point. I think it's one which hopefully our bats and our offense can just help sort out, because that's the other side of the coin, is that on the one hand, our bullpen hasn't been as strong as advertised. On the other hand, our offense has been sporadic. It's been either, you know, feast or famine, boom or bust. It's been both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, we saw a lot of that stuff also last year. And Espada, I'm going to go sort of Jekyll and Hyde on Espada for a second. Let me start with the good stuff with Espada. He didn't get five Astros starters injured. You know, he didn't demand for Singleton and Abreu at first base. You know, he wasn't the reason why these guys in the bullpen that we just talked about are awful. I mean, is there any part of what's going on with Espada, George, that he could have done something about, you think?
I mean, first base is an interesting one. What does he do about that situation? Because the pitchers is in up the back end of the bullpen. I would say, yeah, you have to stick with it, and these guys will find their level again. With Jose Abreu, I mean, it was a slog watching him last season until he finally somewhat caught fire in September. But this year, oh my goodness, he's just completely fallen off a cliff in terms of his numbers. Zero production. He's almost, you know, he's actively hurting the team being there. His defense isn't good enough to justify him being there for that reason. So I don't know what the solution is. I don't know whether Espada has an option in terms of what he can actually realistically put in to make that change. Everyone talks about, oh, you know, can Joey Lopofido come up and do that? I mean, it's, you know, we can't be relying on guys who have never played in the majors to suddenly come and rescue a situation. It's a difficult one. I think it's one which, unfortunately, he won't get much sympathy from the Astros fan base on at large, because his job as a manager is to find those answers. And it's one which I don't envy him for, because
you actually have to play Abreu, because if you just don't play Abreu, you might as well release him. And,
you know,
if that's the case, he's got to go through Crane and Dana Brown, and he's got to go through the higher up. So
there's a lot of money involved there. Yeah.
Yeah. He's got to put him out there and see if he can get out of it. And I don't know how long you do this experiment. Jeff Bagwell worked with him, said, you know, he's okay, just needs to get confidence. You know, he gave the whole spiel of like, there's stuff we can do with him. But, you know, I mean, I just don't know what they do. We talked a little bit about it last week, and I said, well, you know, I think you got to run him out there for 2 or 3 months, but then by June, it might be that decision of we're going to have to eat the money. And Jim Crane, you know, that's all 100% a Jim Crane decision. So that's all on. Look, Jim Crane, as the general manager, was a disaster. And right now he's a little bit in charge of the Josh Hayter situation, because, you know, that was more of his decision than Dana Brown, because he had to agree to spend that money and he knew what that was about. So he's basically 0 for 4. I mean, Montero is pitching okay right now, but he's never going to be worth the contract that they spent on Montero and, you know, Abreu and Brantley. And obviously, I mean, Hayter's not looking great right now either. So, I mean, it's just bad all the way around for him. And you know, that's it's tough to overlook that, but it's the mess that he got himself into.
Yeah. I think you have to look at Dana Brown a bit as well and see how much involvement he actually has had in the decisions that are being made. Is it all coming from Jim Crane and he's just acting as the mouthpiece? I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, we don't really get that sense of who's actually calling the shots there. I know there was an interview which Reggie Jackson gave the other day with the New York media, just talking about the decision-making process. And
I didn't like that, because he was saying like, well, it's you know, we got Bagwell in on it and Biggio. And, you know, if you got five guys in the situation and him and Reggie and all that, you have five guys talking about it. Well, I mean, what's the point of having Dana Brown as your general manager? I mean, I don't get it. They can have input, like scouts can have input, like, you know, guys GM in the organization, but coaches and stuff like that. But it shouldn't be like, you know,
GM should be the one.
Yeah, it should be. It's Dana and bottom line, you know, Jim. But, you know, one of the things that I pointed out is, look, these owners that have early success within their first few years, then when they start thinking they can do this, they're the guy that's behind this and they're the brains. Look at Jerry Jones when he got rid of Jimmy Johnson, and then, you know, Barry Switzer worked out for a year because the infrastructure was there. Same with like the Astros situation, the infrastructure was already there. And then, you know, you go back to George Steinbrenner back in the 70s when he took over the Yankees in the early 80s, by the mid to late 70s, all of a sudden they're having success. And he's thinking, oh, this is me. And then he starts firing and hiring and gets all involved in all the decisions. And it all starts to fall apart. And it took him 16, 17, 18 years till the late 90s before he could bring it all back.
Yeah, the examples from history there. And I don't know how much Jim Crane does or doesn't read into that type of thing. He really should, and because he's been an excellent owner in so many ways. But at the same time, you know, you can undo a lot of that by overstepping the boundaries of what your role is. And that's not, you know, that's not a slight against Jim Crane whatsoever. He's not a GM. He's not a baseball GM. And he's an owner, and he's an excellent owner. But again, you know, it's when you start blurring the lines that it can get a little bit muddy, and things can happen which lead to decisions being made which have a lasting impact, which I guess we potentially are seeing with Jose Abreu and the other deals which you mentioned. I must say I do like Rafael Montero. I think Montero is an excellent pitcher. I don't really know why he struggled so much last year, whether it was the pitch clock introduction which had changed the way he had to behave on the mound, similar to the way that Framber struggled when things went wrong. Because I think there was one period last year where when Montero was pitching, it was like he was just snake bit. He was everything, every time he was out, there was soft contact, something would happen and the innings would kind of fall apart around him. And I think that really damaged his confidence. I think when we're starting to see him look a lot better, which is good, because in 2022, he was awesome. So I'm hoping that he can get to even sort of 70-75% of that. So I'm not too worried about him, but like I said, the other deals, they're not looking so great. And hopefully this Hader one doesn't go that way, because if it does, that's pretty disastrous. So we don't want that to be the case.
Yeah, and I mentioned Jekyll and Hyde with Espada. The other side of the coin with him is he talked a lot about being more aggressive on the bases. Well, the Astros are 21st in steals so far. They've stolen 8 bases, gotten thrown out 4 times. The base running hasn't looked good by any stretch. That's stuff that he put a big emphasis on, along with holding base runners. The Astros tied for dead last. They haven't thrown a runner out yet, George. They're middle of the pack in steals allowed. This, I assume, is not what he wanted from this team.
No, definitely not. I think that our team, when it comes to base running, has always been a bit of an adventure, even through this whole golden era. In terms of the coaching side, we're used to seeing the slightly crazy sends from Gary Pettis at third. And then in terms of the actual players themselves, Altuve, as legendary as he is, he's never been a good base runner, anything but. He's normally quite unpredictable, to put it very gently.
George Springer, you go back to George Springer, and he was a really fast guy, but he was not good at getting steals.
Yeah, I agree. I applaud Joe Espada for recognizing that it was an issue, which it was. I think that we definitely should be looking to manufacture runs when our bats are quiet and put pressure on other teams' defense in that type of way. But we certainly haven't found that combination yet. Like you just said, in terms of the numbers, not good. Disappointed that Yana Diaz hasn't managed to throw anyone out yet, because he's got an excellent arm on him. So I don't really know quite why that's the case.
Looks like it's more still a pitcher's fault, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It's definitely something which we're having to kind of acclimatize to and try and adjust to in the new era of limited mound disengagements and the pitch clock, and just trying to approach that management of runners at first in a different way from what was historically the case, where you keep trying pickoffs and hold them there that way. We definitely haven't found the formula yet, and I think it's important that we do. The thing that's been disappointing for me is that in addition to that, we've had games where we just haven't been looking after the fundamentals, too many errors in the infield, which is something which we've prided ourselves on how elite our infield defense has been over this golden era, and it's something which we really have to make sure is a priority. Because even last night, that play where Jeremy Peña on the spin, he's elected to bounce the throw to Abreu, and then it's gone wide, but then Abreu stayed on the bag at first, and you know, when the sensible decision would have been to just come off the bag, give up, except you're not going to get the out, and just make sure that the run doesn't score. But unfortunately, he didn't, and it's just little decisions like that are going a long way, especially in these tight games. Because I think, which that was until the ninth, I think if I'm not mistaken, we've got a record of something like 1-5 in in one-run ball games this year. In tight games, we are not thriving. The games that we're winning are pretty much all blowouts. So it's something which we have to address. And I think, you know, getting the fundamentals right goes a long, long way towards achieving that.
Absolutely. And Yuli Gurriel's defense was, I think, very underrated by a lot of fans out there. And I want to ask you this, just a quick thought on Spencer Arrighetti that I had after watching him his first two starts. I believe his stuff has more explosion and movement than Hunter Brown. He's got better stuff to me when I watch him than Hunter Brown. Yeah. If his control improves, the upside is better than Brown. You agree?
I would agree with that. Now, I think with Hunter Brown, I'm disappointed that he hasn't noticeably developed since he first broke through. We all remember that first appearance. I can't remember. I think it might have been against the Tigers, where he looked electric, and you're thinking, "Wow, this is exciting." He looks like Verlander. He pitches like Verlander, and in terms of with the fastball velocity and how he ended the kind of high fastball and how he's able to dominate hitters like that. But he hasn't got that secondary stuff, which is imperative at the major league level to be able to get your primary stuff going. Because everyone's got the book on him now. He can't find edges and corners of the strike zone, and we saw that in alarming fashion in that game against the Royals, where it was just like he might as well have been a pitching machine. It was just hit after hit after hit. Was it 9 runs on 11 hits in the first inning? It was actually frightening to watch. So to go back to what you said, Arrighetti looked like he's definitely got exciting stuff, which will offer him the opportunity, should he be able to keep it under control and keep that command, that will offer him potentially more weapons and more varied ways of attacking hitters than Hunter Brown does. But, you know, I don't want to give up on Hunter Brown. I think it's just games like tonight are a big test for him. He has to show that he's learning. You know, last year, the reason, we all know one of the reasons why he struggled the second half of the season was because he hadn't pitched that many innings in a season before. And that's fair enough. You know, his arm practically fell apart towards the end of the season. So that's fair. You know, that's a young pitcher learning how to manage his body through the rigors of a 162-game season. But that excuse won't cut it this year. You have to be able to adapt. That's the name of the game, is that, you know, everyone knows what everyone's doing. You have to work out how to adapt to how they've adapted to you, and you have to work out how to manage your body and your command and just your general entire way of approaching the game. And so far this season, Brown hasn't shown that.
Tough question maybe for you, but I'm gonna hit you with one. Which pitcher do you have more faith in long-term, JP France, Hunter Brown, or Spencer Arrighetti?
I would go with Arrighetti as being the one who has the most upside. His ceiling is definitely highest for Arrighetti. I like JP France. I think he's an excellent pitcher. Has he hit his ceiling? Possibly. I think it's one of those ones where I don't know whether he's got that much more he can do with what he does. He looks like he's going to be a solid, dependable guy. Hunter Brown, I am worried. I'm not going to deny it. I am worried about him. I just think that it's a case of, we have to see how it goes. But Arrighetti definitely has the highest upside. So I'm on that basis, it's a big shout because he's only had two appearances at a major league level. But I'm tentatively edged for Arrighetti. How about you?
Yeah, I definitely like Arrighetti more than Hunter Brown. The middle ground, the median, I kind of trust the floor of JP France because I don't think he's going to have the rough outings that we've seen. And he really hasn't had many of those. I mean, you know, he definitely had one the other day. But yeah. I don't see him having a – like his, not ceiling, but his floor, I would say, is a little bit higher than the other two guys because I think he could be more solid. But yeah, I would say the high upside is definitely the Arrighetti because I just love, like I said, I love this stuff. I mean, the ball moves like a wiffle ball with him. And you don't see that with the other two guys. To the starters, the assumption with the Astros injured starters by, I think, some fans is, well, Verlander, Fromber, and Akiti are about to come to the rescue. But George Fromber hasn't been Fromber since last June. Verlander is 41 years old with two stints on the injured list in the last year. And Urquidy's career ERA, he's not some ace. He's got a career 4 ERA with the Astros. Are we putting too much faith in the veterans coming to the rescue here?
Slightly. I said in the offseason that if everyone's healthy, we've got a potentially elite rotation. But it was also quite possibly a house of cards because you have a couple of injuries, which is exactly what we've seen. A couple of injuries and the whole thing falls apart. I do worry with Verlander that Father Time will come knocking very hard on that door very soon. There will be a year where he just won't have it anymore. And he's somewhat playing Russian roulette to say and depend on him to be this ace again in 2024 at his age. I think he's going to be good. I think he'll be. I don't think that we're going to see that cliff decline this season. I certainly hope not. It would be pretty disastrous if it was. But I think he'll be solid. I don't think he's going to be spectacular. I think he'll be what we need. Framber's an interesting one. Framber is a fascinating one. For so many reasons, love the guy. I think his story is phenomenal. We all, you know, we've seen him mature as a pitcher in many ways, but then we've also seen him regress as a pitcher over the last year. So it's peaks and troughs. And I think that what we see over the next month from him, presuming that he is actually healthy, will be a big indicator as to what kind of year we're going to get from him. Because if he's able to master his own emotions under the pressures of the pitch clock, then we're in business. Because he's that curveball is a thing of beauty that when he's got it totally under control. And the ground ball rate that he lives off is phenomenal. When we see him at his best, he's an extremely dependable pitcher. But that's why it was shocking last year in that second half of the season where he was getting roughed up left, right, and centre, and he seemed to be losing his composure a lot. He was hitting batters after giving up runs, most notably against the Rangers, and it was worrying because we know his history of, I'm not saying this in any kind of derogatory way, but in terms of his mind state and the whole having the sports psychologist who's worked with, which is an admirable thing, which he's done over the course of his career up to this point. But we need to know if he can keep himself together. If he can, we're fine. If he can't, then no. As for Jose Akidi, always been a big Akidi fan, but yeah, you're right. He's not an ace. I mean, he's the kind of guy who is at his best. You're kind of looking at him in the postseason, looking at someone who can deliver a good start as as one of your late starters in a series. But in terms of the regular season, you're not going to be relying on him as the kind of spine.
If he's on, you can go deep with him because he throws strikes. But yeah, he's a 4-5 pitcher, and that's all he's really been. And
yes,
and I don't think he's going to be around after his contract's over with. I mean, there's a lot of bad stuff we talked about. But George, what's your biggest positive so far? Is there anything that's got you excited?
Easy, Jose Altuve, he's on fire. To see him, I love to call him the little boss because that's exactly what he is. He's a giant in so many ways. Absolutely love the guy. And to see him, it's thrilling to see him come out the gate just making contact and hitting bombs and leading from the front. I know his numbers with runs and scoring position haven't been good, but then again, not many have in the team. So that's something which we have to address as a whole. But I love watching him play. It's an honor and a privilege, and with him having that security of the next 5 years as an Astro, to be a lifelong Astro is a wonderful thing. We're very blessed to be able to watch him play, and to see him hitting like this is a massive bonus, because you never know how we're going to start season. We're obviously used to seeing Alex Bregman start seasons very, very slowly, which again has been the case this year. But I think seeing Altuve there and with Jordan behind him, that's that for me is a big positive. I know Tucker's had a few, had some good games in the last week, which is another boost. We have to make sure that if we're struggling pitching wise, that we're covering that gap as best as we can with the bats. I know that you can't do that for ad infinitum, but you certainly can do it in the short term. And if we can help lighten the load for our arms with the bats, then I'm all for it. And Altuve leading that charge is a wonderful thing to see.
Never heard of this Altuve guy, but the ladies tell me I need to watch this guy Jeremy Peña, and that's my biggest positive is he's hitting. I mean, and wasn't doing that last year as good as we thought he was going to be, at least with the power. And it's a big deal if you've got a young, just in his third year, you still should have him under control for a while. If this guy's going to be an elite defensive player and a really good hitter, if this hitting is close to legit, that's something to go along with the young Yonder Diaz, Jordan Alvarez. I mean, believe it or not, he's still pretty young. So yep. you still got some really, really good young core guys. One bit of good news also, right before you and I started to record, the Astros first round pick in 2016, Forrest Whitley, the pitcher, was called up by the Astros and will be on the major league roster for the first time. Whitley will be the 22nd Astros pitcher used this year. That's the most of any team in all of baseball, George. Mm-hmm. And they only used, to put this into a little perspective, 24 pitchers all of last year. They've already used 22. I'm not even counting the great right-hander that we have on the bench, Greg Kessinger. If you want to count him, that'll be another pitcher, 23, that they've used. But, I mean, he should, Forrest Whitley, George, should be taking the mound for the first time in the majors, unless he tears up his knee walking out of the dugout.
Let's not jinx it, because it's been so long getting to this point. But yeah, I'm thrilled for him on a human level. We've all seen his story. There's so many injuries and setbacks and what have you. It's a great thing for him to finally get this chance. And I'm sure I speak for all Astros fans when I say I hope he grabs it with both hands. And I'm really looking forward to seeing him.
Yeah, he's got some great. I mean, when you watch just the minor league outings that he's had, and you watch the stuff, it's legit. And I'm just happy for the guy because he's been through a lot, and it'd be a great comeback story. I mean, a guy that really came back from not having the chance to come back, if you want to put it that way. But hey, and also the good news is, just so everybody knows, the Astros, I mean, as bad as it looks, Las Vegas, that seems to know something about something when it comes to sports, still has the Astros as the fourth favorite to win the World Series. Don't ask me how, but they're still the fourth favorite after everything that's going on with them. Before you go, I just got to ask you, because I know a lot of fans got to see your journey to Houston for the first time. through your Twitter handle, your X handle, Astros Fans UK. But just out of curiosity, besides the Astros and seeing them in person in Minute Maid Park, if you were to tell anybody that's coming to Houston, hey, what three things, what three places, what three things do I need to do when I go to Houston? Because people don't think of this as really a tourist town. What would be the three things for you? What did you love most?
Well, I mean, I would have to say the food was incredible. I'm not going to name drop a couple. I could name drop places, to be fair. I mean, I don't know if you're happy with me name dropping places, but
honestly, maybe they'll sponsor us, so you might as well.
I mean, yeah, I went to the Breakfast Club, and that was a revelation. That was awesome. Where'd I go else? Brothers Taco, Kobo's. I forgot the name of the place, but it was there was so many great places, and I barely scratched the surface. I can't wait. I can't stress this enough. I can't wait to go back to Houston. I don't think it's going to be this year, but I'm going to try and do my level best to get there in 2025 again, because it was awesome. The next thing I would say was just the generosity of the people. You know, people talk about Southern hospitality, and coming from the UK, I hadn't really ever experienced that before. It's so true. It's such a real, genuine thing. The warmth that I experienced from everyone that I came across was nothing I'd ever experienced before. It was phenomenal. I feel like I'm smiling just thinking about it, but I feel like Houston will be a destination for me for life. I've got lifelong contacts that I've had from online, but also lifelong contacts which sort of made in person. It's just the best place. It's so slept on as a city, amazing city, Houston. And on that point, the third thing I would say is walk in Houston, because everyone drives, and I wasn't driving. I was walking around downtown. People thought I was insane because of the heat, but honestly, it's a lovely city, and I think it doesn't get that kind of spotlight in a way which it should. It's, you know, there's so much going for it, you know, the art, the across the board. Oh man, I'm my thoughts are all blurring into one, but I can't wait to go back, and I would just say to people, just explore it. It's a lovely, lovely place, and the people are just the best.
I can't agree with you more. I mean, I'm biased. I grew up here and I've lived here most of my life, but yeah, you mentioned the art. It's one of the best art cities in the United States for sure. I think that's underrated. I live right near Buffalo Bayou Park, and you know, Houston's known for concrete and ugliness, but you know, they're not to me. I mean, Buffalo Bayou Park, Miller Outdoor Theater, and the whole Herman Park area is a really great area to go to, and it's beautiful. And obviously Memorial Park, everybody loves Memorial Park as a place to go to. So yeah, Houston, just tons to offer to people. It's hard when I tell people that are coming into town, like, what should you go see? You know, because everybody's looking for destinations, and outside of NASA, they don't know what to do. And, you know, so I try to do that sort of stuff, and, you know, try to send them maybe to the water wall, because that's kind of very...
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, I went there. I definitely would like to go back.
And I think even people in Houston forget how cool the San Jacinto Monument is. That's, you know, very similar to the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C. And you know, that's kind of a cool thing. It's not close to anything, so it doesn't get maybe the publicity. And I love Galveston as well. But yeah, we're just really glad you got a chance to finally come here. And we love that you've made this your team and your town. And I just can't thank you enough for coming on the show and sharing a little bit with us. And we need to do this again sometime soon for sure.
Absolutely. No, it's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed speaking with you. And thanks for having me on the show. As for Houston, I'm so grateful that I've been sort of welcomed in with open arms by you guys. And it's mutual. It's a mutual thing. And I can't wait to come back.
Yeah. If you haven't found it by now, it's Astros Fans UK on X. Go check them out. Last thing to plug? Anything you want to plug before we go?
Yeah, also Astros Fans UK on Instagram as well. I've even just started up this year on trying out a different platform, even on TikTok. I'm just doing these kind of like daily recaps, which I'm sharing on X and on Instagram as well, but sort of a next day kind of look back at the game from the night before. But yeah, just at Astros Fans UK, and on TikTok is at astrosfans.uk. But I'm really loving interacting with everyone that follows me, and I do the live tweet play-by-plays during kind of 99% of Astros games, no matter the time of day it is over here. Like for example, tonight as a standard night game is a 1:10 a.m. start for us, which is always fun. And I must emphasize, I'm not ever doing it for clout. It's not about me. I'm just a fan. I'm just trying to grow this fan base. I love being an Astros fan, and I love seeing and connecting with Astros fans in the US and in Europe and all around the world, and trying to grow this thing, because it's a wonderful club in a wonderful city, and you know, we can build something wonderful together.
Hey, thanks a bunch, George, and go Stros.
Pleasure. Go Stros.
You're listening to Houston Sports Talk.
Hey, don't forget to support us by subscribing and commenting on YouTube. You can always listen to us on Spotify, Apple, or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends about us and share our show links on social media. Spread the word, everybody. Thanks for listening.